Trump and the Europeans, they assume that they've got leverage with Russia because they actually believe their own nonsense about Russia's economy being in trouble. I can't emphasize enough that they genuinely believe this. And I'm here to tell you it's a load of crap. And that Russia has what's known as strategic depth, that they can, as we've seen, they can shoot 20,000 artillery shells a day, and they are producing enough in their factories to replace those. Whereas in the West, cannot do that, including the United States and Europe combined, cannot do that. They cannot match Russia's production just by itself. Russia with only 140 million people. So this theater is going to continue with the old peace talks, attempt to have peace talks. Putin has nothing to say to Zelensky.
Larry Johnson, good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
Hey, Andy. Thanks for having me back. I'm glad I didn't wear my welcome out.
No, not at all. As I mentioned previously, one of my few go-tos when it comes to geopolitical events. I love your analysis, and trust is probably a better word, your analysis of the geopolitical environment that we're in. Let's get to it. We had a very interesting, I would say, and surprising and important meeting in Alaska. And then it looks like, correct me if I'm wrong, everybody flew out to all of Europe and Zelensky flew out to the White House. What do we make with this, and start with the meeting with Putin and Trump in Alaska?
So I was in Moscow in December of 2023, and I had a conversation at that time with the deputy foreign minister, the number two guy, whose name is Sergei Rybkov. And Mr. Rybkov said at the time that the problem they had was, he says, we don't have anybody to talk to. We're trying, but all normal diplomatic channels have been cut off, which is just insane, because even during the height of the Cold War, even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for God's sake, Russia and the United States, or at that time Soviet and U.S. Diplomats and politicians, were talking to each other.
Yes.
So Friday represented a breakthrough in that regard. Finally, U.S. and Russian officials are talking to each other. Now, if you've watched all of the build up and hype around the meeting, particularly with all the pundit, the so-called pundits on television who were predicting, oh yeah, this is going to be forcing Putin to have a ceasefire. They viewed this as this was Trump coercing Putin into this, that, Putin didn't really want to do this, but his back is up against the wall. His economy is collapsing. They're losing militarily. Oh my God, Putin's looking for a way out, and here's Donald Trump, the savior. He's the new Jesus Christ, here to bring salvation to Moscow. It's all nonsense. This was a step in the right direction in terms of Putin held this meeting, and actually, I think this was planned well in Witkov had met with Moscow with Putin just the previous Thursday. And the way the narrative came out was, oh, it was out of that meeting that they decided to have this meeting on the 15th. No, this thing had actually been in the works for a lot longer than that. I believe Witkov's trip to Moscow was to finalize some of the details, get all that ironed out. But the date of the meeting was significant. It was August 15th. It marked the end of the war in Japan, in the Pacific, the war with Japan from World War II. It was the 80th anniversary. And what most Americans don't remember is that Russia also entered that war with Joseph Stalin fulfilled a promise he had made to Franklin Delano Roosevelt at the Potsdam or the Yalta conference, I guess the previous February. And that was probably one of the major motivations for the Japanese to surrender, not the nuclear bombs. In fact, we have General Douglas MacArthur, General Dwight David Eisenhower, General Hap Arnold, General Curtis LeMay, all of them are on the record stipulating that Japan was going to surrender. They didn't need the bomb because of what Russia's involvement. But anyway, they had this meeting. Trump still doesn't understand the cause of this war. He's pretending, oh, now I've got to get Putin and Yeltsin and Zelensky to talk because they're just having a disagreement that's led to this war. And if we just get them to talk, that'll settle the disagreement. Wrong. That's not at all what this is about. Or, oh, let's just swap some land. This is not a dispute over land. This is first and foremost a war against a NATO proxy, a country that was built up, an army that was built up with the express purpose of attacking and destroying Russia. Don't believe me, just read it in the National Interest of a guy, former State Department diplomat, who's buddies with the new Deputy Secretary of Defense, Elbridge Colby, fellow by the name of Aaron Wes Mitchell, published a paper in August 2021 in the National Interest. That was then, it was really previously submitted to the Department of Defense Policy Planning Group in December of 20. And what it lays out is provoking a war with Russia from Ukraine, defeating Russia in order to use Russia to force Russia to come ally itself with the West and then go after China. That's what, you know, China's the big kahuna here. That's what this is all about. So if you recall, in December of 21, Joe Biden received a draft security treaty from the Russians and initially indicated they'd take it under consideration. But then in January, Anthony Blinken basically told the Russians, you can shove it where the sun doesn't shine. You're not going to tell us what to do. And so the Russians said, all right. And then the Russians were watching the buildup of Ukrainian forces on in the Donbass, and they launched that. They launched preemptively then the special, what we now know as the special military operation. This is about getting NATO out of off of Ukraine's borders, away from Russia. And Trump and all of the Europeans, that they either understand that and don't want to do that because they still hold out hopes of destroying Russia, or they're, you know, they're deliberately ignorant. But it's, you know, Russians have been very clear about this. So all this political theater, like what we saw on Monday, it was Trump, oh, I got to get Zelensky and Putin together to talk about what? The issue for Russia is the United States installed two Aegis missile systems. Now the Aegis normally is on a destroyer and fires missiles, air defense missiles that'll take down, say, a ballistic missile coming in. Well, the problem with those Aegis systems, you can also load them with a Tomahawk cruise missile. A Tomahawk cruise missile carries a nuclear warhead. And you can't tell just by looking at the outside of the launchers what's inside. That is an existential security threat as far as Russia considers it. So this, when you hear the Russians talk about root causes, what they're talking about is dealing with these security threats from Europe, from NATO. And, you know, NATO and the United States have consistently turned it around claiming, oh, Russia's out invading everybody. Really? Russia, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The first time Russian forces left to enter a neighboring country was in August of 2008. And that was because since the end of 1991, Russian soldiers had been posted there as peacekeepers, separating the people of South Ossetia from the Georgians. So it was on they were doing peacekeeping duties. The government of Georgia's military attacked the Russian soldiers. That's why Russia then went to the defense of its soldiers. That was what that war was about. This was a provocation, again, from the West. because Shalikashvili, the Georgian president at the time, was seeking entry into NATO. They were talking about making them a NATO state. And Russia warned, no, keep Georgia out of NATO, keep Ukraine out. So that was, that was Russia's invasion of Europe, okay? The next one was in 2015, when Bashar al-Assad of Syria asked Russia, come help us fight these Islamic radicals. And Russia did. That's been it until the launch of the special military operation. Meanwhile, the United States had been conducting military exercises every year. In fact, during Donald Trump's term in office, and this shows you how much he doesn't understand his complicity in this, the U.S. military and NATO carried out more military exercises in Ukraine for the 4 years that Donald Trump was president than any other president previous to that, okay? And it included maritime operations with U.S. Marines landing on the shores of Ukraine. That's not a defensive exercise. That's an offensive action. And in all those exercises, the target is Russia.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Russians have been watching this buildup go on and on and on until NATO decides we're actually going to disband because their only reason to exist is to fight Russia. And Russia's not interested in fighting them, but if Germany, France, and the UK insist on sending troops to be peacekeepers now in Ukraine, they will be killed, and we face the genuine prospect of World War III. It'll be quick because Europe doesn't have the ability or depth to fight it.
Yeah, let's work that out a little bit more. It seems to me that Russia has all the cards really in all of this. They have the resources and also the real estate, the territory.
Yeah.
God, you want. And it doesn't really, and the other reason why this is being prolonged is because we, meaning the US and the European allies, NATO, want it to be prolonged. So really my question is twofold. Why even have a meeting with the NATO leaders then? I mean, it's like, is this going to accomplish anything? Because Russia has all the cards and seems like they're going to be dictating terms. And really, the second question is, do you see this even escalating further if NATO doesn't have any resources, and the only reason they have resources is because of us, correct me if I'm wrong. If they go in there and occupy, it makes no sense of them going in there occupying, because that would be the start beginning of the end of NATO and an implosion of really Europe. Correct me where I'm wrong in my analysis.
Yeah, no, you're correct. Look, Zelensky's visit, I described it as, you know, Zelensky was there with his European pimps, you know, he's their prostitute and they're all, you know, he goes out, collects the money and they get the money, right? Hey, great deal. You know, the oldest profession in the world. The economics of this, because, you know, a lot of your podcasts do focus on finance, economics and such. That's where people really need to step back and look at this, because you're being fed, they're being fed a meme right now. Oh my God, Russia's economy is, it's teetering on the brink of destruction. It's going to collapse because they're only growing at 1.5% this year after being 4.7% last year. But then you notice nobody wants to mention the fact that the central banker, Nabulina, instituted an anti-inflation program that started last October. She did raise rates up to 22%. And as a result of those rate hikes, economic activity slowed. But this was not unintentional. This was intentional because the Russians are very inflation averse based upon the two bouts of hyperinflation they experienced in the 1990s. And so since October, and just in the last 2 months, she's been cutting rates. So the rates are coming down, and inflation is down to around 9%. So what you saw was deliberate action. However, let's deal with the underlying strengths of the Russian economy. Also, the Western said, oh, they got 2.2% unemployment. They got a labor shortage. They can't keep this up. When have you ever heard 2.2% unemployment as a problem? Okay?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's a sign of weakness. Hey, let's look at their debt to GDP ratio. 19%. Okay, now, current, after all of the spending for defense spending, they're still bringing in more money than they're lending out. In contrast, the United States debt to GDP ratio, 125%.
Right.
Great Britain, 100%. France, 110%. Germany, is its debt is rising as its economy has shrunk into recession. And almost, I don't think there is a single, I think Portugal is the only country in Europe that's growing above 0.5% right now. The rest of Europe, they are stagnant economically. How in God's name are those European countries who are part of NATO going to come up with 5% of their budget to pay into NATO and to buy all these weapons from the United States and then resell them to Ukraine? Where's the money going to come from? They don't have it. They're broke.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you realize how many of those countries with the debt level we have in this country and how many in Europe are in similar positions and with stagnant economies, a global financial crisis has got to be there on the horizon. This can't go on. This is unsustainable. And instead of taking measures to open trade, to make credit easier, to improve, if you will, cash flow, all we're doing is, it's tariffs, you're raising taxes, essentially. You're creating barriers to trade. And, this is all going to be like, I think it's going to be like a perfect storm when it comes together. So against this backdrop, Trump and the Europeans, they assume that they've got leverage with Russia because they actually believe their own nonsense about Russia's economy being in trouble. I can't emphasize enough that they genuinely believe this. And I'm here to tell you it's a load of crap. And that Russia has what's known as strategic depth, that they can, as we've seen, they can shoot 20,000 artillery shells a day, and they are producing enough in their factories to replace those, whereas in the West, cannot do that, including the United States and Europe combined, cannot do that. They cannot match Russia's production just by itself, Russia with only 140 million people. So this theater is going to continue with the old peace talks, attempt to have peace talks. Putin has nothing to say to Zelensky. It's not like Zelensky can come in and go, yeah, Mr. Putin, you need to pull your troops out. Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, those former oblasts of Russia are now republics of Russia. It came about through a legal process, at least legal under Russian law. The rest of the world may reject it as illegal, but, Russia say, wave at the rest of the world and say, we don't care. They are legally part of Russia. Putin can't give them up. He can't say, okay, I'll let you have 25%. It's no more than Trump could tell Putin, hey, here, I'll give you Alaska if you get out of the Donbass. Neither president has that power. So this demand that they're going to make some land swap, I think the most that Russia would be prepared to do is if Ukraine withdraws all of its military personnel from the Russian territory that they now occupy, Zaporizhia, Kherson, and Donetsk, Luhansk, and recognize those permanently as part of Russia, and agree to kick NATO out and have no further relationship with NATO, then Russia will withdraw its forces from Dnipropetrovsk Poltava, Sumy, Kharkiv, because that right now they're advancing in those other four oblasts. And Russia's made it very clear to Ukraine, either you settle down on the terms we're offering with, you know, the recognition of the existing territory, or if this war goes on, we're going to take additional territory. We're going to take Dnipropetrovsk, Kharkiv, Nikolaev, Odessa. That will become permanently part of Russia, and Ukraine will be completely landlocked. They will have no access to the Black Sea, and certainly they have no access to the Baltic. That's where it's headed.
Do you think that is inevitable, or do you think that Trump or NATO sees the writing on the wall here that, you know, that Putin has all the cards?
No, they don't. They don't recognize. Some may, but I think the majority don't. They believe their own press. They really believe that Russia has suffered 2 million casualties. And you know, the U.S. intelligence community is telling Trump that. The reason I'm pretty confident saying that is that's what Cy Hirsch said, this U.S. intelligence official told him. And, you know, I tried to explain to Cy that, hey, those numbers, you can just sit down and do the math yourself. It's not that hard. Go back and you get the starting figure for what the size of the Russian army was in February 2022. You then look at the number that were added to the army with a September mobilization, followed by a conscription, which took place in November of 2022. Then going forward for 2023, 2024, and now 6 months into 2025, every month there was about 30 to 40,000 conscripted. And then there was another 20 or 30,000 that were signed up as contract soldiers. You know, they joined up for the money. Well, right. You can add all of that up, and it brings you up to like 2.3 million men that have been brought into the service since February 2022. You haven't made any adjustments yet for people whose contract was up after a year who went home. No adjustment for the number who have actually been killed in action, the number that have been wounded in action, the number that have deserted, 2.3 million. But what we do know is that the current size of the Russian army in Ukraine is 650,000, with an additional 600,000 back in Russia on reserve. So about 1.2, 1.3 million. Well, if you start with 600,000 and at the end of 3.5 years, you've got 2.3 million that have passed through, and you're saying you've got 2 million casualties, that means you've only got 300,000 left. So where do the other million people come from? Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be great at math to do this. It's not like advanced calculus or something. It's addition and subtraction. And yet they believe, these leaders believe, oh yeah, Russia suffered terrible losses. I mean, you keep hearing Trump talk about it. He thinks, yeah, that's a motivation. I'm going to dangle this before Trump or before Putin. That, yeah, here, Mr. Putin, you'll stop losing all these guys and I'll make you happy. Putin's looking at him and said, what are you talking about? Yeah, Russia suffered losses. I think the most closest metric is used by a group called Media Zona. What they've done is they've counted obituaries, and they read the obituaries on a daily basis throughout all of Russia. And they estimate about 160,000 KIA over 3.5 years. Now that's still a lot, but
significantly less than
2 million. Yeah. Now, you notice that today news is out that these hackers got into the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense's computer system, and they're now producing numbers. I've got the actual spreadsheets. 1.7 million Ukrainian men dead or missing. 1.7,
which is a country, is culture survive that?
Well, they don't.
Right.
Well, they do sort of. Paraguay, the story of Paraguay back in the 19th century. I think it was the tripartite war. That is like 80% of the men, 60% of the men in Paraguay died. Wiped out a whole generation. So that's what Ukraine's going through right now. It is, they do not, and that's why they're having so much difficulty on the battlefield now. They don't have the trained cadre. Now, what the West wants to do, what Mertz, they want to pull another Minsk II. So Minsk II in January of 2015, the militias of Donbass from Luhansk and Donetsk, they had support from the Wagner group out of Russia. But Russian military was not officially involved with this. They had the Ukrainian army surrounded and were going to defeat them. And it was at this place called Debaltseve, which is in the northern part of Donetsk. Angela Merkel, Francois Hollande, Germany and France respectively, got on the plane, went and begged Putin to intervene, to call it off, and they promised they would do this peace agreement. And that's what led to Minsk II. Minsk II was brokered by Russia, France, Belarus, Germany, but it was agreement between the Donbass and Ukraine. And as Angela Merkel admitted years later, it was done in order to buy the Ukrainians time to rebuild their military, to get properly armed, properly trained, so they'd be ready to go for the next battle, which is exactly what happened. And Putin has admitted publicly that he was fooled, that he got played, he got taken. He's not going to let that happen again.
Yeah, it won't happen again.
And that's exactly what Mertz and these others are proposing. Oh, let's do the ceasefire in place. And all they're going to use the ceasefire for is the time to rebuild, maybe catch a breath where they can finally train some soldiers before shoving them onto the front line. Because right now they really don't have any training, effective training. And the reality is to get soldiers of a minimal competence, you need about 5 to 6 months of training. Minimum. And they're not getting that in Ukraine. So that's the problem.
So what's the expectation or your expectation here moving forward? Do you expect Russia to continually march, if you would, gobble up Ukrainian real estate, if you would? And do you expect the West or NATO and the U.S., and I'd say the U.S., that nothing's changed, to continue to send money and weapons over there to stop or try to stop it?
Trump's going to come under enormous pressure to essentially break off relations with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, he's on the right path in terms of opening up the contact, talking, getting back to normal diplomacy, where he can actually talk about the issues. Russia is, their military campaign, they're not going to slacken off at all. In fact, the Russian general staff and Putin sent some pretty tough messages yesterday, day before yesterday, when they hit this oil terminal. Yes, it's called the Sokar, O-C-A-R, that is owned by Azerbaijan, but it was based in Odessa. And this Sokar facility was both storage and refinery. It was a refinery, stored oil, stored gas, and shipped it all over Ukraine. So it was a key logistics hub for the Ukrainian military. And it also ships to Israel. Israel may be having some fuel crises now with this facility taken out.
Go figure.
Yeah. And the reason that, so why didn't he touch it previously? Well, previously Russia thought it had a decent relationship with Azerbaijan, but what's transpired over the last 3 months. It started with the June 1st attack on the strategic air assets of Russia with those drones.
Mm-hmm.
That came out of Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan was instrumental in helping carry out those attacks. And then Azerbaijan's role in facilitating Israel's attacks on Iran. So this one oil terminal accounts for about 15% of Azerbaijan's gross domestic product.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're not talking a few cents. We're talking a major cut in income for that country. And it was the next, probably the toughest thing you could do short of launching the troops or bombs themselves directly into Azerbaijan. So the message has been sent. It's the old FAFO, you know, the FAPO.
Yeah. So real quick, then this could be completely another conversation, but you said something interesting in the beginning of this talk that really China is really what NATO and the U.S. are after.
Yes, yes.
Tell me about that and your thoughts on that. That's the first I've heard of this, but it's quite interesting.
Yeah, and again, the article, look up A. West, W-E-S-S, Mitchell. I don't recall the title of the piece offhand. Let me see. Do I have it up on my computer? I might have it up here. I can. Yeah, here it is. It's titled. Go back.
I can link to it.
A strategy for avoiding two-front war. Let me just send you the link in the chat. Because this is really guiding a lot of U.S. policy. Elbridge Colby, who's the number two guy in the Department of Defense.
Got it.
A. Wes Mitchell's his buddy. And, they are in sync with this, that, they want to disengage if they can from fighting Russia so that they can go after China. And
crazy.
Well, China has, we built up China. And now China it can stand on its own two feet. In fact, it could do things that we certainly can no longer do. Do them a lot better. And we keep trying to paint this as a strategic threat to us because they're economically more powerful than us. That's where, they're the number one industrial country in the world. They have a far higher literacy rate in China than we do in the United States. I mean, in the 1950s, the United States had a literacy rate in around 95-96%.
Yeah.
China, meanwhile, was down still probably in 30%, 40%.
Yeah.
Today, China's at like 98% literacy. The United States is at 71%.
Yeah. And that's probably at a sixth grade reading level.
Well, in fact, they said 70% of adults can only read at the sixth grade reading level.
Yeah.
Which means no critical thinking ability.
Right.
And so this is, it was trying to be a war of choice that frankly, we can't win. We cannot militarily defeat China, short of using nuclear weapons to wipe out those people. But that would also lead to the end of the United States. So instead of finding ways to say, look, how can we cooperate? Let's have, the key to diplomacy is having some empathy and understanding why others think the way they do, why they act the way they do. Now, if sometimes you can come up with a psychopath where somebody is just completely psychotic, they are completely lacking in reason. And therefore, no matter what you can do to empathize with him, you have to take him on. You have to lock him up. You have to kill him. I understand that.
Sounds like some of our leaders.
But, yeah. But Russia and China aren't that. They're not psychopathic countries. They are very logical, smart countries. Do they have problems of their own? They're far from perfect. But neither Russia nor China has spent the last 70 years attacking and carrying out wars in other places, unlike the United States. Mm-hmm. Korea, Vietnam, Central America, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria,
yeah,
Libya.
Yeah,
I mean, we keep Serbia. We keep going down the list. You know, we're always looking, and now it looks like we're going to attack Venezuela.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, stop.
Yeah.
We're like a drug addict, and we just can't help ourselves. We're addicted to war. So, and these other countries now they're reacting to the United States in that regard. So, this project, I was in on a Zoom chat the other day with a group of investors. You know, a lot of these are guys that are, you know, if I gave you some of their names, you'd know them. They're some are Wall Street people, and they were really genuinely believing that we've got to help Russia see the light of day, that we're the best friend that they can have, that they want to be with us, not with those nasty Chinese, because the Chinese are just going to treat them like second-class citizens. Now, in all my dealings, when I was in my first trip to Moscow in 2023, I stayed at the Intercontinental Hotel on Tverskaya Street, which is just, you know, about 10 blocks north of Red Square. Went down to the breakfast room. I thought it was in Beijing. I was the only, you know, Caucasian guy in there. They're all Chinese. So China and Russia are actually getting along quite well in a way that they never have in history. They are united politically, economically, militarily, diplomatically. And that's happened because of us. Our actions over the last 3 years has driven them together in closer cooperation and bonds of friendship than ever before. And yet we've got this policy, as you'll read that paper, they believe we can really peel off Russia and there will be all, they'll have the world united to go after China. What kind of madness is this? It's a sickness. It's an insanity that possesses us in the United States. And we just need to, you know, I don't know if there's a 10-step program or a 12-step program, but we need to step away. Stop it.
Yeah. You know, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe, I know Russia wanted into NATO, and this was in the early 2000s, or they wanted to join NATO. And correct me if I'm wrong, it was really for protection against China. And then completely, it seems like it's completely reversed now.
Yeah. Well, actually, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 91, Boris Yeltsin, then the president, asked Jim Baker, and then asked George H.W. Bush, that can we join NATO? No. You know, it was resurfaced. He resurfaced the request, I believe, in 98. Then in August 1999, Putin took over, and Putin submitted the request to Bill Clinton in 2000. And to George H.W. Bush, I believe, in 2001, 2002. Rebuffed every time. Yeah. And there was more, you know, what Russia was seeking was to build, let's call it a European security arrangement. And the United States had zero interest in that. Why? God, if we get rid of, if we allow Russia in, what's the reason for NATO to exist?
Exactly.
We've lost the raison d'etre. You know, the reason for being. No, we got to keep you around, man. We need an enemy. I don't know if you've ever been in the Hollywood environs and had a chance to go pitch a story or pitch a script.
Never.
And when you walk into the room, the question from the executive is, oh, okay, who's the villain?
Right.
Got to have a villain. For a great story, great drama, you got to have a villain. Russia is our villain. You know, we tried it with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, but, you know, we were sending so much money and support to those guys anyway. It's sort of tough to make them the big enemy when they're helping do our dirty work for us, just like we did in Syria recently.
Yep.
They now call him Al-Shara, formerly Al-Jalani.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know, that guy in 6 years carried out 27 times the number of terrorist incidents in 6 years that the Palestinians, not just Hamas, the Palestinians did in 25 years. Okay?
Yep.
And yet, Oh, we can't talk to Hamas. Oh, they're evil. Oh, yeah. Jelani, hey, buddy, come in. Got money. We got hugs for you. Yeah, just wear a suit. As long as you wear a suit, we're okay with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's sickening.
Yeah.
So, you know, anytime you hear somebody talking about a terrorist threat, just pull out the red flag, throw a penalty. If you're American talking about fighting terrorism, you've got nothing, no right to talk about it. Because right now we're facilitating the greatest terrorist acts in the world in terms of what's going on in Gaza. But that's a whole number, another subject.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to talk about that. It'd be a different talk, Phil. But one thing I wanted to ask you with your background, and I don't know how comfortable you are commenting about this, but it seems like the CIA, the intelligence community is being turned over as we speak. Is this real? Is there hope in this? Because I certainly hope so. Yeah, with Tulsi Gabbard coming out there and cleaning house, or is she cleaning house?
Yeah.
You know, all that.
Yeah, not really. So we've had the revelations surrounding Russiagate based on documents that Tulsi released.
Think about that, everybody.
Yeah. The specifically with the intelligence community assessment that was released to the public in January of 2017. We've now got the emails and the documents and actually testimony that was a completely cooked up piece of intelligence, that they ignored other information that would have rebutted the conclusion that Russia interfered in the election and secured the election win for Trump. That's the story that John Brennan wanted to tell. That's the story that Clapper wanted to tell. That's the story that James Comey wanted to tell. Interestingly, Mike Rogers, who was then the head of the National Security Agency, didn't want to tell that and push back. And there were apparently the director of analysis at CIA, a senior, you know, this would be someone who's a senior intelligence service person, equivalent of a 3-star general, pushed back and said, no, we don't have it, but we're overruled. So there are still some people, at least on the analytical side of the house out at CIA, I believe, who are still have their integrity intact. However, based upon, you know, two stories that Cy Hirsch has written recently where he's quoted senior intelligence officials, both quoting them with respect to casualties and with respect to Russia's economy and situation, they're lying. They are absolutely, they got the information completely wrong, and they're lying. And as I showed you with the numbers just going through, I can prove that they're lying. And yet they continue to put that information out. So it's almost, I'm at the point where the bureaucratic structure of the place is such, they need to be burned to the ground and start over.
Yeah.
You know, there's too much. The bureaucrats can just hang on. All they have to do is hang on and wait out. Wait for Tulsi to leave. And once Tulsi's to leave, then they can go back doing their own thing.
Yeah. Well, Larry, you're always so gracious coming on, and you're very, very reachable to me. And I just want to thank you for that. If people want to follow you, know more about your work and your analysis, where do they go?
Sonar21.com, SONAR21. That stands for Son of the New American Revolution, 21st Century. And I chose that because I've got 28 ancestors that fought in the American Revolution as militia. And my fifth great uncle, Charles Thompson, was the Secretary of the Continental Congress. So I got roots to how this country was founded. And yeah. I believe in the better half, but we got some, you know, we've got some dark chapter and a lot of, you know, if you will, blood on our hands we need to answer for. And right now, instead of being a force for peace in the world, we're being a force for death, mayhem, and destruction.
Yeah, I'm very, I agree with you, and I'm very sad that I agree with you. Larry, I can also see that the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree from your ancestors. So I want to thank you again so much. And again, to all my viewers and listeners, Larry's been just exceptionally gracious to me. And he is one of the handful of people, there's less than a handful that I go to get my intelligence from. So thank you.
Hey, always happy to help and glad I can contribute something. Thanks, Sandy.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.